From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, how do humans control bicycles? Scientists know less than you might think about this complex task. Local researchers aim to change that. Plus, the poetry of Doreen Jeanette and Afro-Cuban jazz from La Descarga. First, a new study says Governor Schwarzenegger's proposed budget could cost California the equivalent of 331,000 full-time jobs. This comes from the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. Center researchers also propose an alternative budget that they say would save California nearly 250,000 jobs. In a few minutes, you'll hear a reaction from the governor's office, but we'll start with Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Labor Center and co-author of the study, The Economic Consequences of Proposed California Budget Cuts. Ken Jacobs, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me on.
How did you reach your conclusion that the governor's proposed budget could cost well over 300,000 jobs?
Well, in order to do this study, we used industry standard input-output modeling software, Implan 3.0, and modeled each of the elements in the governor's budget, and then modeled some alternative revenue sources to see how those would affect jobs, how they would affect tax revenues collected by the state. The state is in a serious economic or deficit crisis. Measures do need to be taken, but most measures designed to reduce the deficit will have a depressing effect on employment and economic growth in the state. But the magnitude of those impacts vary significantly depending on the kinds of measures that are enacted. What has the biggest negative impact from the governor's proposal are cuts in health and human service programs, which would result in the loss of close to $7 billion in federal matching funds. And those federal matching funds act as a stimulus on the state economy. There's a multiplier effect as they go through the economy. And that's really where the greatest part of the job loss comes from. In fact, we estimate all of those effects would result in the state losing nearly $2 billion in state and local tax revenue.
So loss of federal money is a big part of this. How else would jobs be lost, according to your analysis of the governor's proposed
budget? The other element is that when we look at the cuts in health and human services, low-income families tend to spend all the money that they earn and to spend it locally in the economy. So some of the biggest places where you see the large impacts are cuts to CalWORKs, California's temporary assistance for needy families, and in-home supportive services. In-home supportive services is especially large because those dollars go straight to hiring people to work with seniors and disabled people to help them stay in their homes and avoid going into nursing homes. And those workers earn an average of $10 an hour. So the cuts to in-home supportive services alone would result, we estimate, in the loss of a little over 100,000 full-time equivalent jobs. If you consider part-time, it's closer to 160,000. And then another 20,000 jobs that would be lost from those workers not spending that money in the local economy.
Give us some examples of the kinds of jobs that would be lost according to your analysis.
Well, so what we look at is both the direct effects. So if you make cuts to Medi-Cal, then people who are directly working in hospitals and clinics would lose work. Then there's the suppliers to those hospitals and clinics. And then there's the retail outlets and the other establishments where the people who earn money in the hospitals, clinics, and their suppliers spend the money that they earn. So you really have this ripple effect that continues through the economy. And to say more than half the jobs that would be lost are jobs that are in the private sector.
Roughly how many would be public sector jobs?
It's of the 330,000 jobs, it was a little less than half. So around, I think, 48%. The bulk of those, the biggest group of those would be the in-home supportive service workers.
Do you have a margin of error for the 331,000 full-time job?
I think it is important to say that this is done using this economic modeling software. It doesn't produce margins of error in that sense, but obviously, as in any of these cases, it could be more, it could be less. What was most important here, in fact, because we're looking at full-time equivalents, the actual number of people affected is likely to be much greater. But the important thing here is to look at the comparisons. So, for example, the governor's proposal includes $2.1 billion in corporate tax breaks. And if we look at how many jobs would be gained from cutting corporate taxes, it just pales in comparison to the number of jobs that would be lost by cutting social services that bring in these federal matching dollars.
Ken Jacobs of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education and co-author of the study, The Economic Consequences of Proposed California Budget Cuts. Also with us is Aaron McClear, Governor Schwarzenegger's press secretary. Aaron, welcome.
Hey, Jeffrey. How you doing?
Well, I'm fine. What does the governor's office, what does the governor say in response to this study?
Well, first of all, something that Ken didn't mention, you didn't mention, this study was quite literally bought and paid for by the state employee union. So it's no surprise that the proposal is to increase taxes to pay more money to state workers. So I think that's an important thing for your listeners to know. This is paid for by SEIU. We simply disagree. We don't think that increasing taxes any more than we already have is the way to go. This says nothing in this report about the pension crisis. Right now we're paying state employees $32 billion this year in salary and benefits. And that's something that we need to look at. That's something we need to dial back on. And it's something that was missing from this report.
Just for the record, I had planned to bring up the fact that the UC Berkeley study was funded by the Service Employees International Union, but I had figured that you would probably bring it up, Aaron. I thought that was the appropriate way to handle it. Ken Jacobs, well, what about that source of funding?
If I could respond on both of those points. First, on the issue of the funding, the Service Employees International Union asked us to do this, knowing we had developed a methodology, which we had put out in reports earlier, looking at these particular kinds of questions. And the report was reviewed by faculty economists here at UC Berkeley. And I would be very interested in hearing from the governor's office critiques of any particular part of what it is that we say. On the question of the pension crisis, I think it's important to note that what we were looking at was potential solutions for this year's budget, you know, what will happen this year, next year, while we're in this economic crisis. Anything you do to pensions would have no effect on the budget till a decade or more down the road, because under law, the state can't do anything with people who are current state workers. So while there are some issues that are going to be grappled with around pensions, those really aren't relevant to the question at hand in terms of the budget choices that the state has to make now in this budget. And we have real choices between options that will minimize the negative economic impacts or options that will make the crisis in our state worse.
Ken, you said that the study was reviewed by UC Berkeley faculty. Still, the Service Employees International Union has a vested interest in maintaining the level of public spending. Why not look elsewhere for funding for a study on this very topic?
Well, as you all know, we face the same difficult economic situation as everyone else. I mean, the reality is we had done original research in this area, funded through a grant from the California Endowment as part of the work we were doing on that grant. And SEIU asked us if we'd apply those methodologies to the full budget, which required significant extra work, and we didn't have another funding source. And I can tell you that having having those funds did not change in any way the outcome nor the rigor of the review that was given to the research.
Aaron McClear, let's talk about the federal matching funds, because Ken Jacobs said that that's one of the biggest factors here in their analysis, that the governor's proposed budget could cause the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs. How did the governor factor in the loss of federal matching funds into his proposed budget?
Well, Ken's right on that, and that's an unfortunate consequence of having to make these cuts. If you start with the fact that the governor is not going to raise taxes any more than we already have. Remember, last year we increased taxes $12 billion over a three-year period to the voters, and by a 2-1 margin, the voters had the opportunity to extend those tax increases, and they know. And so we're not going to do any more tax increases. So if you're not doing tax increases, you're doing cuts. And there's only so many places you can cut. There's a lot of federal lawsuits, a lot of other factors that keep us from going into most parts of the budget. Health and Human Services is one of the only parts you can go into. These cuts are horrible, no question about it. These cuts are tough. Nobody wants to do these cuts, but we can only spend the money we have, and we have to make tough choices.
Ken Jacobs, isn't it one thing to be using software to make an economic analysis of a likely impact on jobs, and another thing to actually put together a budget that at least aspires to be balanced starting July 1st.
Right, and that is exactly why when we did the work that we did, rather than just look at the question of how many jobs would be lost from the governor's budget, because we know they had to make difficult decisions, we insisted on looking at what would happen if you did an alternative. And what we found is there are alternatives the state could do by raising revenue, postponing the governor's tax cut to corporations, moving the tax rate for the highest earners back up to what it was a number of years ago, and putting in an oil severance tax. California is the only oil-producing state without one, just enough to cover the costs of maintaining those social health and human service programs and not losing those federal matching dollars. We looked at to find a responsible alternative and found you could save nearly a quarter million jobs by doing so. We think that's more responsible.
Aaron McClear, I think you probably already answered those suggestions earlier, but just for the record, does the governor support raising the tax in upper-income households to the level that it used to be?
No, and that's why this is not a serious proposal. This is, you know, what he's saying is we need to increase taxes on rich folks to protect state workers. There's nothing in this report, it's strange since it's funded by SEIU, that says anything about cutting back on state employee compensation and benefits. We don't believe that punishing employers who are creating jobs is the right way to get our economy back on track to pay for these programs. When you put revenue into the state, to get more revenue in the state, you need to not punish employers and encourage them to create jobs, which is exactly what our proposal is going to do.
What about the oil severance tax? California is the only major oil-producing state without a tax like that. Even Alaska has a high oil severance tax rate.
You're right. The governor proposes tax increases. Again, it's a philosophical difference between us and SEIU. We don't believe we should be raising taxes any more than we already have. We believe we need to encourage employers to create jobs, to give them incentives to grow here in California, create jobs. If they create jobs, we have more revenues coming into the state, and now we can pay for some of these programs that unfortunately we have to cut back on right now.
We'll wrap this up now. Ken Jacobs at UC Berkeley, any final thoughts from you?
Yes, it's important to remember that many of the jobs we're talking about, in fact, the majority are private sector jobs. If we lose those federal dollars, if we lose the spending of those low-income workers in the community, the jobs that are going to be lost, who's going to go out of business is our small businesses that serve those local communities. So it is the private sector and it is small businesses that will suffer from this budget proposal.
And Aaron McClear?
Well, again, it's a difference of opinion on whether or not we should be raising taxes. And we just disagree. This report essentially says, let's increase taxes on rich folks. Let's protect state workers. It doesn't say anything about the crisis we're cutting back. And we disagree. We can only spend the money we have. We have to make the tough decisions to get there.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. You just heard Aaron McClear, Governor Schwarzenegger's press secretary. And also with us was Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. He's also co-author of the recent study, The Economic Consequences of Proposed California Budget Cuts. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, local scientists studying how people ride bicycles. Their research could yield better bikes and a better understanding of how humans interact with machines. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can stream Insight live or later at capradio.org/insight. Today in Talk of the Nation Science Friday, a similar blowout forced oil into the Gulf of Mexico for 9 months 31 years ago. After all that time, why don't we have better prevention and cleanup technologies? Plus, how to turn your old computer into a planter. And bird expert Bernd Heinrich and his new book, The Nesting Season. That's Science Friday after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. How do humans control bicycles? It's a complicated skill, and scientists know less about it than you might think. But the lessons to be learned from studying how people ride bikes are important. Two engineers at UC Davis are working on this very matter. They are Ron Hess and Mont Hubbard, both professors of mechanical and aerospace engineering at UC Davis. Ron Hess, Mont Hubbard, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks. Same here.
Ron, what are the main challenges that we deal with when controlling a bicycle or riding a bike?
Well, the interesting part of a human controlling a bike is that he or she must utilize all of the sensory feedback information necessary for controlling a vehicle in general. We generally break those up into three categories: visual information. Second, something we call proprioceptive information. That's knowledge of what control inputs I'm putting into the handlebars that are sensed by these proprioceptors in our arms. And thirdly, there's something called vestibular information, information about the rate at which I might be tipping over or the accelerations I might be experiencing. And controlling a bike really requires all three of those. And that's not necessarily the same for controlling an automobile or, in many cases, an airplane. We can generate a simulator for an aircraft that involves no motion of the subject at all, and it would be fairly adequate. But you really can't do that with a bike. The challenge with a bike is all that information is absolutely required.
Mont Hubbard, it's such a strange machine, I guess, in a way, a bicycle, because your contact with the ground is minimal, and the contact is just two points that are in a straight line. Does it even make sense that we can ride bicycles?
It does make sense, I think. First of all, we can see people riding bikes every day, and we do. We know we do. But in a way, that double point of contact, which seems minimal, gives you some agility. It's different from having four wheels in contact. And frankly, you can do lots of things on bikes. You can make very short turns and do tasks that would be difficult in a vehicle with more contact.
My guests are Mont Hubbard and Ron Hess at UC Davis. They're engineers, and they're leaders of a team researching how humans control bicycles. Mont, I read that you said, we don't have a precise scientific understanding of how humans control bicycles. Given how long we've been riding bicycles, why don't we know more at this point?
That's a good question. Perhaps it's because it's such a complex problem. One of the things that has been learned in the last couple of years is that certain motions of body segments can affect the stability of a bicycle that we never imagined might. For example, one of our students was in Delft, Holland last year working on bicycle dynamics and control research. And what they found in some of their experiments was that the knees actually move, and that the human probably is unconsciously moving certain segments, trying, because they have learned that that helps them to stabilize the bicycle, whereas we normally think of a bicycle as being controlled only by the handlebars, but I don't think that's true. The human has lots of segments, and everything can be moving, so it's very, very complicated.
Well, that's interesting. Ron Hess, how can you study the various ways that humans control bicycles? How are you conducting the research?
Well, one of the advantages, I guess, or one maybe to answer, to add to what Mont's statement, is that one of the reasons that this is now a reasonable field of study is that sensor packages, those devices which you could put on a bicycle to measure the motion quantities and accelerations, have become smaller and smaller and lighter and lighter. And that's a real help. If I have an aircraft and I have to put on a 30-pound sensor that weighs 30 pounds, it's no problem. But if you put that on a bike, it's a big problem because you alter the dynamics of the bike itself. So I think one aspect of why this research may be interesting at this point in time is because the sensor packages that we have are getting lighter and lighter. So we can put them on the bike without interfering with the dynamics of the bike themselves. And what we hope to do, and what we're entering in now, are some tests in which we have an instrumented bike and give the rider a task. And the task means maybe it's what we would call in an automobile a lane change maneuver. Go along a straight line and then quickly move the bike over 2 meters or 3 feet to the left and restabilize. And then using the measurements that we can obtain from the bike, accelerations and angular orientations, we can back out what the human was doing, at least initially in a relatively simple sense. But as Mont pointed out, you're using a vast array of muscles and body movement when you do this. Riding no hands is a perfect example. Here is a bike which is unstable and inherently unstable in most of its speed regimes, yet a reasonably adroit rider can ride it no hands. Well, the reason he or she can do that is because muscle groups are being used, obviously not the hands controlling the handlebars.
I see. Mont Hubbard, give us a couple of examples of the benefits that society could get from this research if it works out.
Well, I think if it works out, we'll understand, we'll have a mathematical model for what the human is actually doing in the control task, controlling and riding the bicycle. And we'll be able then, hopefully, to understand how the design of the bicycle itself affects the human's ability to control the bike. Right now, I think bicycles are designed just based on experience, really, and the designers sort of know what works and what doesn't, but they don't know it in any scientific or mathematical sense. So one advantage will be that we'll be able, perhaps, to design bicycles that are very easy to ride for different segments of the population, kids, geriatric populations, Lance Armstrong populations, and normal riders. So I think that'll be an advantage. But I think perhaps the most important advantage is that if we are able to design bikes that are easy to ride, more people will ride them, and then this is going to help us in our global carbon problem. Most of our carbon emissions come from transportation, and the bicycle puts out very, very few carbon emissions. It's the most efficient transportation vehicle around.
Ron Hess, you are a nationally recognized expert on how pilots interact with aircraft control systems. Is studying how humans interact with bicycles a step down from that kind of high-stakes work, or is it actually more interesting?
Well, it's more challenging. It sounds maybe a strange thing to say when you have modeling a pilot controlling a huge 747 aircraft to a child controlling a bicycle. But I found it actually is more challenging, again, getting back to the fact that the sensory information that the human uses typically exceeds that a pilot might use, at least in the context of having to use all this information simultaneously. So I have found it to be challenging. I probably had a preconceived notion that this is going to be a simpler task than it is, but at every corner there seems to be an element that surprises me that I didn't account for, that I had to account for just getting the system rider and bicycle stable.
And are you both active cyclists, Mont Hubbard?
Indeed I am. I'm still sweating from my ride into the office this morning.
I usually ride in once a day, usually in the afternoon, and we are spoiled here in Davis. I've got a 10-foot wide bike lane that I can take from my front door right up into my right up to the building here on campus. So it's a wonderful community to be in from that standpoint.
Yes, indeed. Mont Hubbard and Ron Hess, they are professors of mechanical and aerospace engineering at UC Davis, and they're the leaders of a team researching how humans control bicycles. Mont, Ron, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the earthy poems of Davis writer Doreen Jeanette. Her first collection is just out. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's more about our guests and topics at capradio.org/insight. Monday at this time, At War in the Pacific, a radio documentary based on the Pacific by Hugh Ambrose. It tells the real-life stories of young Marines fighting the Japanese in World War II and is a public radio companion to the HBO series. You might recall the author, Hugh Ambrose, was a guest on Insight earlier this year. Insight returns on Tuesday. We'll feature the four candidates for the highly contested position of Sacramento County Sheriff. We'll include some listener questions. If you'd like to submit one for consideration, there's an email link at capradio.org/insight. Nature, whether animals or plants or weather or wild places, crops up a lot in Doreen Jeanette's poems. You can read them in Urchin to Follow, her first collection just published by the National Poetry Review Press. Doreen Jeanette lives in Davis. Doreen, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's an unusual title, Urchin to Follow. It's one of the poems in your book. What does that mean, urchin to follow?
Well, very literally, it means urchin to follow, as in anemone now, urchin to follow. Octopus now, urchin to follow. I'm putting an urchin in the mail to you in the next package that I'm sending you.
An everyday routine.
Certainly, certainly. And I guess the idea with a title like that is to try to attract the kind of readers who would like to receive an urchin in the mail, to try to attract readers with a high desire for whimsy, as I have, and, you know, hopefully have a meeting of the minds on the page.
My guest is the poet Doreen Jeanette. We'd love to hear you read a couple of your poems. Let's start with You.
Certainly. You. God, I could put out your eyes, I could put out. I could wring my hands, my snakes. There it is, damn its stench, the error house. Yes, you embarrass me, you easy liquor. I'm done dredging gutters for honeysuckle, for the dumb fuzz from your thighs. It was your clover-choked windmills that threw me. Anyone would understand. A basement is where I keep my receipts.
Mm. Your poems are so concrete and so full of physical things. Is that the kind of poetry that you like to read?
It is. It certainly is. And for me, the attraction doesn't have to be that a poet uses the kind of things I most like to encounter. I love Frank O'Hara, who's a great poet of the city. And I am the least urban person that you might hope to meet. My impulse whenever I'm in an urban area is to get out of it as fast as I can. But I like to visit it courtesy of Frank O'Hara's brain. So I do love to encounter the things of the world, but they don't have to be my favorite things. I like to find things through someone else's perspective.
Well, maybe it's just coincidence, but all the poems that I read seem to feature things that you don't necessarily associate with the city, but nature, animals, weather, you know, places like lakes and oceans and so on. Is that where you are drawn personally?
It is. It is. And I'm always wanting to learn more about the facts of the natural world. But certainly my experience of the natural world is maybe the most crucial thing to me as a person. You know, if I want to get my head together, the first thing I do is go outside, you know, and I've always been a hiker and a backpacker and so forth. So I tend to problem solve, I guess, in terms of thinking about bird behavior that I see outside my window or whatever else.
Do you write poems when you're hiking or backpacking?
I don't. I think I tend mostly to, I don't know, sing silly songs and eat a lot of junk food when backpacking, because one can. But maybe it's those experiences. I might tend to work through a poem that's already in progress, you know, over a stretch of trail. That's a good kind of problem solving in my mind time for me.
Tell us, if you can, how you wrote the poem that you just read for us, You. What's the story behind the poem, where the idea came from, and then how it actually became what it is?
Sure. Well, the story about the literal origins of the poem are that through odd changes in circumstance, I at one time lived next door to a house I had at one point occupied with a very bad boyfriend. And so literally, my office window looked next door on the house I had used to occupy with this person, which was easy to ignore because by then, you know, a lovely couple had moved in there and I didn't think about it that often. But I think one day I was trying to work on something or other and I was looking out that window. And looking at that house was just, it was just really bugging me that it just wouldn't go away. And which is how poems often start for me. It bugs me that something will not go away. So I guess I was just trying to make that poem as compressed as possible. You know, sometimes after a when you're thinking about a past relationship, things get very crushed together. Memories get kind of crushed together. And maybe a long period of emotion is crushed together. So that's what's going on there.
Are you saying then that it was longer and you just kept boiling it down and down and down?
Yes. Yeah. And I usually work that way. My friend Matt Forsyth, who is a wonderful fiction writer, talks about being an accordion writer and having a process whereby you brainstorm and you dump out all of these pages and pages and pages of material and then cut back. And then you look at what you have and you do it again. So you write maybe 10, 20 times as much as you use.
Has your yucky ex-boyfriend by any chance read the poem? Does he know about it?
I doubt it and I hope not. Yeah. but I'm glad that you picked this poem because that end, you know, a basement is where I keep my receipts. Out there in Radioland, you can't see this, but a basement is one word. But of course, I also mean a space. Basement. And people have loved that and people have hated that. I've gotten in big trouble for the end of this poem.
I see. Are you a person who likes puns in general?
I love puns, yes, but there are many pun haters in the world and I hope to convert them.
Doreen Jeanette, she's a poet. She lives in Davis. Her new collection, her first, is titled Urchin to Follow. Let's hear another poem. This is an unusually titled one and I've already forgotten how to pronounce it. Epithalamium?
Yes, epithalamium. Which is just a long word for a poem about a wedding. And this is dedicated to my friends Tegan and Robert Summers, and I wrote this about their wedding. Epithalamium. Swallows gather at the lake mouth's fog, nearly the hour of speech. Under the shoreline gazebo's beams, fan blades tick the light chain, keeping time until the bridesmaids' heels commence their clicking to a string quartet. Dearly beloved, we are gathered by the creak of folding chairs, green voices from the shadows on the lawn. How will she arrive, the bride, her long, long train? Aboard a craft of wooden wheels, into the flower girl's beckoning blooms, stems crushed in the carriage spokes release their scents to the groom. Love, hold, honor, cherish, until I will. From will on, I apply my will and I wish, desire, spilled on the tongue of the lake, tasted in that slower world.
Well, who would have thought there'd be a word for a poem about a wedding?
Oh, there's a word for everything. That's the joy of the English language.
You were at that wedding, I guess.
I was at that wedding, and it was such a surprising wedding. It was an outdoor wedding, a lakeside gazebo. And, you know, there we all were in our chairs and the music is starting and we're all turning around in our chairs looking for the bride. And she is nowhere to be seen. And for an agonizingly long time, she is nowhere to be seen. And then she comes sweeping around the corner on this horse-drawn carriage, you know, drawn by Clydesdales or whatever, those gigantic horses, and is helped down. I mean, it was this beautiful sort of, it was like Cinderella, this fairy tale wedding. And I remember thinking, if they had asked me, is the carriage a good idea? I would have said, it's the cheesiest thing ever. Don't do it. But it was actually one of the prettiest things I've ever seen. And it was just one of those magical evenings where everything seems to coalesce. The frogs are going and the birds are going and the wedding is happening. It was beautiful.
And did your friends who were getting married say, Doreen, you're a poet. It would be so romantic
right.
if you wrote a poem about our wedding.
No, they didn't. And in fact, I didn't tell them that I was working on it for a long time because I was worried they wouldn't like it. You know, that's an intimate thing to borrow from people. And then finally I thought, well, I'll see if I can publish it and I'll send Tegan a copy as a present and I'll have to hope that she likes it. And then this was published first in a wonderful online journal called Terrain, a journal of the built and natural environments. They deal with architecture, botany, poems, everything, urban planning, you name it, it's in there. And Tegan actually saw it online before I told her about it. And I was very lucky that she did like it and contacted me to say so.
Yes, no doubt. You've also written an essay with the intriguing title Semicolon Slut.
I have.
What's
I
that
have.
About?
Oh, I'm so glad that you ask. I took a number of wonderful classes at the University of Georgia from Judith Ortiz Kofar. And Judith is just a wealth of wacky ideas. And at some point in a writing class with her, there was an assignment to choose a piece of punctuation and write an essay about it, write a craft essay about it. And I am always in love with the semicolon. I overuse the semicolon with abandon. And so my essay, Semicolon Sluts, came out of that class. There's also a humdinger of an essay on the colon that came out of that class. It went well. And it's my contention that the semicolon is the most erotic piece of punctuation.
It
is quite a statement. And it's because it's the most ambiguous piece of punctuation. Many other pieces of punctuation tell you exactly what the relationship is between the parts of the sentence. They direct your attention. All the semicolon does is it says, well, there's a connection between these two independent clauses, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. You know, it's like that awkward moment at the end of the date. You have to decide, are we going to kiss or are we going to not? I don't know.
It's like two ideas flirting with a union.
Exactly.
And they're not
yes.
sure if they're going to or not. And the semicolon acknowledges that. But at the same time, I forget who it was, but there was some writer, maybe Frank DeFord, who slammed semicolons, saying they're so wishy-washy and ambiguous. But I guess you're saying that's the beauty of them.
I am. And that's where context comes in. I discovered recently someone had borrowed that or quoted from that essay in a business blog and had said, well, you know, this writer is correct. Semicolons are great for, you know, arty sort of circumstances. But man, if you need to communicate facts in a hurry, leave those suckers out. And he was right. You know, subject, audience, purpose. Where are you putting them?
Doreen Jeanette, poet. Her new collection, her first, is titled Urchin to Follow. It was published by the National Poetry Review Press. Tuesday evening at 7, she's at the UC Davis Arboretum speaking in their Writers in the Garden series. Doreen Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Afro-Cuban jazz from Sacramento quartet La Descarga. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions. Send them to insight@capradio.org. There are many flavors of jazz and blues at the Sacramento Jazz Festival in Jubilee this weekend, including Afro-Cuban. Playing that music is Sacramento quartet La Descarga. They also have a new CD out. The band is in our studio. They are Dave Bass, pianist, vocals, Bea Godinez Moniz, who plays conga, percussion, and lead vocals, Harold Moniz, percussion, timbales, and Dominic Garcia, bass, percussion, and vocals. Welcome all to Insight.
Thank you so much for having us.
Happy to be here.
Dave, La Descarga, what does that mean?
La Descarga literally means discharge, and it's a Spanish word that Cuban musicians have used to mean jam, just like in English, jam, which is really a crushed fruit and sugar, turns out to be a chance for musicians to play together and have a jam. And in Cuba, it came out that it was descarga, meaning like, let's all get together and we're gonna play and jam together.
Harold, how important is the jam to Afro-Cuban music?
Well, it's very important because, like jazz, it a lot of the Afro-Cuban music has expression, free kind of expression, and not so much arrangements per se.
The band La Descarga also has a new album out. It's called La Descarga, and we're going to listen to some music from that. Let's start with their version of Fly Me to the Moon, which in Spanish could be translated as A la Luna Me Voy.
A la Luna Me Voy. A la Luna Me Voy. A la Luna Me Voy.
Dave, how do you all come up with the arrangements for this? And in particular, this one, because when it starts out, who knows where it's going to go? And then, oh, it's Fly Me to the Moon.
Well, this is a great one to talk about, because this, probably more than any other song on our CD, was really a group arrangement. Not all of them are group arrangements. This one, each of us brought a little something different, all the way from Ralph Kramden and To the Moon, Alice, which was in our heads from the old Honeymooners TV show, to Frank Sinatra doing his great Fly Me to the Moon version. Bea came up with what we call the coro, which is that beginning part, Para Luna Me Voy, Take Me to the Moon. So we just took those lyrics, which is part of the Afro-Cuban vocal tradition. You take lyrics and then you play with them and come up with something. So as I remember, Bea came up with the coro, which we did at the beginning, Para Luna Me Voy, and then I'm playing the melody. And we all just sort of added little pieces until we all decided we liked the arrangement.
Bea, you're the lead singer for the band, and one of the songs.
No.
One of the songs on the record is a very beautiful song, Drume Negrita. We're going to listen to a clip of that, but first, what does that mean?
Drume Negrita is sleep, young baby. It's an old Cuban lullaby that is sung to, you know, a baby like any other lullaby. It's just so beautiful, and I love singing it.
Okay, well, let's hear how it starts.
Mama na negrita, se le salen los pies de la cunita, y la negra merced. Ya no sabe qué hacer. Tú, drume negrita, ¿qué voy a comprar? Nueva cunita que tenga.
That's really beautiful. Bea, you were born and raised in Oakland. Are you of Cuban descent?
No, I'm Mexicana.
Yeah.
Mexicana.
How did you get into Cuban music then?
Well, I started actually doing salsa, singing salsa with my one of my sisters. And in the Bay Area, there's such a beautiful, rich culture, so many cultures. And it was mutual friends started a Cuban a dance group, which was Afro-Cuban and Brazilian. And so that's really how I started in the Cuban and the Cuban genre, dancing and singing and then playing.
And you and Harold are married, correct?
Yes.
Yes. Harold, what about you? Are you of Cuban descent?
No, I'm Puerto Rican American.
Yeah? And so how did you get into Cuban music?
Oh, I just started playing the conga drums and in San Francisco, where I was born and raised, and I just started hanging out. And it's Cuba, for me, has probably out of all the Caribbean islands, probably the most diverse styles of drumming and stuff.
You know, we've talked about Cuban music before in our program, and it seems like there's a little bit of a controversy over how much the music is Cuban, how much is Puerto Rican. Where do you stand on that?
Well, being a Puerto Rican, no. No, I have to say, because there is, I always hear that, but Cuba was really the heart of all of it. A lot of it went to Puerto Rico, as well as other islands, and the United States, New Orleans. But Cuba is really the heart of it.
Let's bring into the conversation the band's fourth member, the band being La Descarga, Dominic Garcia. What's your background in Cuban music?
It's right here in this room, actually. Harold and Beatriz have an Afro-Cuban drum and dance ensemble, Ebo Ococan, meaning offerings from the heart. And I want to say maybe it was in 96 that I was introduced to Harold and Beatriz, and I auditioned for the group. And by that time, I had listened to a lot of CDs, and I actually took a class at City College with Don Young. And it was like one of the first world music classes that they offered there, and that's kind of like where I connected with it, and I just fell in love with the music and any milk and cranny that I could find to learn more about it was, you know, where I was kind of aimed, and I aimed myself toward that, and you know, I just kind of fell in love with it and just became it, I guess.
Dave Bass, you were a musician in the 70s and early 80s, and then your career took an unusual turn. Tell us how you got out of music, what you did, and how you got back in.
I got out because I fractured my wrist.
Bit of a problem for a pianist.
Yeah, and it was my right hand. Though on the gig, it actually was on the way to a gig, I slipped in a puddle of oil, and because I was wearing my tuxedo, I tried to catch myself with my right hand, which did save my tux, but ruined my wrist. So since at the time I liked to argue a lot and read, I figured I'd become a lawyer. And
get paid for arguing and reading.
Yeah, which is what happened. And now I'm a deputy attorney general with the California AG's office in civil rights enforcement. I just gave up music for over 20 years.
And so it wasn't that you couldn't play music, you just drifted out of it at that point.
Well, I couldn't play initially.
Initially, yes.
And then because I had a young daughter, I realized I just needed to find another way to make a living. And I really enjoyed going to law school and doing all that. So I did, at that point then, I left it behind me.
And when did La Descarga come together?
About a year and a half ago. Harold gave me a call. Harold and I, although we didn't play together in the 70s in San Francisco, we were all part of the same scene. And somehow we managed not to actually play together, which we've never been able to figure out. We all know a lot of the same musicians and knew each other's name. And then we ended up, for different reasons, up here in Sacramento. And then Harold gave me a call and said, hey, you know, I want to do this jazzy Afro-Cuban thing. You want to do it? And I said, okay. And that was about a year and a half ago. We did our very first gig the April in 2009. So
let's listen to one more song from La Descarga's album. This is the first track. It's called La Comparsa. It's a really nice song. Harold Muñiz, this was written by one of the greats of Cuban music, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Lecona.
Ernesto Lecona.
Yeah. Tell us about him.
Oh, I think Dave
maybe
would be
Dave is,
Dave
Dave's
the guy
to
answer
to.
That one.
He's often called the Gershwin of Cuba. And that song was written in 1928, if you can imagine that. And his most famous song, of course, is Malagueña, which as an 8-year-old, I played.
Yes.
And lots of people played. He's born in Cuba and wrote literally hundreds of songs. La Comparsa is one of them.
My guests, La Descarga, Afro-Cuban jazz quartet from Sacramento. They're playing 4 concerts this weekend at various venues in Old Sacramento and the Sacramento Jazz Festival in Jubilee. 2 concerts Saturday afternoon, 2 concerts Sunday evening. They also have a new CD out. It's called La Descarga. Thanks so much for joining us on Insight.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's Insight for this week. Insight's theme is written by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Mara Ponce, Jamie Crowell, and Esteban Hernandez. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard, and the executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.